This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, poems you can touch. Dorian Locks had been writing poetry since she was 12, but she never considered making poetry her way to earn a living. Then a poem of hers was published in a local San Francisco magazine called Five Fingers Review. A copy of the magazine ended up in the hands of Philip Levine, who sent the editors a note. Please, tell this woman I love her poem. It was the start of a new life. A book was published, then another. She started teaching at the University of Oregon and giving workshops all across the United States. Last year, she published her sixth book, her new and selected, Only As the Day Is Long. I thought we'd start with going way back. Did you grow up around books?
Yes, my mother was a great reader. She read everything, you know, the popular novels of the day, just like everyone else. But she also was studying to be a nurse, so she read, you know, psychology, biology textbooks. You know, I think one of my favorite books of all time were Strange Skin Diseases, which, you know, I loved.
Yeah.
But also, you know, classic novels, the political works of the day. So, yeah, I grew up around books a lot.
And did you ever read them to you or share them in any way?
Not really. I mean, when we were very young, of course, she read books to us. But mostly she sang us French songs before we went to bed, lullabies.
Yes. Did you speak French? Was that something that you learned, or was that just some foreign language that she would sing?
Yeah, it was a foreign language that was spoken in our house, but only when her sister, my aunt, and my uncles were there. They would all speak in French. And it was really the secret language. You know, they didn't want us kids to know what they were talking about, but they also wanted us to assimilate, and so they didn't think there was any need for us to learn French. Where she had come from back in New Brunswick, French Canada, Nova Scotia area, the French weren't really very well looked upon, you know, historically there. So she loved the idea of getting away from all that and coming out and being a Californian, you know, a real American.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then when it was time for you to think about what to do after high school, what were you thinking of studying? Did you want to get a job? How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, this was back in the day when a young girl was supposed to get married after high school. And so that's what I did. You know, I got married and that was my way of getting out of the house. And I went to school kind of scattershot here and there. I'd take a class here or a class there, community college, after work type night classes.
Right.
Because
right.
I loved it so much. But I didn't really think I was going to do much with it. It was just mostly for my own enjoyment. But I always worked.
Yeah. And you worked so many different jobs. I mean, there, you know, just a few of them. I found you cooked at a sanatorium. You worked at a laundromat. Mm-hmm. You waited tables in Alaska. You cleaned houses. You sold TV magazine over the phone. Which one was your favorite?
Gosh, what was my favorite crappy job? Hard to say. You know, I loved being a manager of a gas station, and I hired all my friends, and they were a motley crew, and I really loved that because I worked with my friends, and I was able to give them something. I was able to give them a job, and it was fun. You know, we just all liked each other and had a great time.
Yeah, and where was that?
That was in San Diego, California.
Mm-hmm.
It was Douglas Oil Company Fast Gas.
Right.
That was when you could just drive right through, get your gas, and get going.
And so you had to help people pump gas, basically? Or
at one of the Douglases, I pumped gas, yeah. And the second one where I managed it, it was by then they had the little booths where you sat in the booth all day and sold gas, of course, and oil and candy and treats.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how should I imagine, like, you know, if you're working in a booth like that, what were you doing in between customers?
Well, I worked the graveyard shift for quite a while. That's where I did most of my reading. I would read and read and read, and hardly anyone would come in. The rest of the time, it was fairly busy during the day, and so you didn't have much time to read. But we would keep running commentaries. We'd keep a little journal of all of the customers that came in to the gas station, the ones that were most memorable. And so we had a great little book filled with stories of gas station, patrons. Yeah.
So basically, this book was like shared between all the people who worked there? Yeah. That's amazing. Do you want to read the poem Fast Gas?
Sure. This is for my first husband, Richard, Fast Gas. Before the days of self-service, when you never had to pump your own gas, I was the one who did it for you, the girl who stepped out at the sound of a bell with a blue rag in my hand, my hair pulled back in a straight, unlovely ponytail. This was before automatic shutoffs and vapor seals, and once, while filling a tank, I hit a bubble of trapped air and the gas backed up, came arcing out of the hole in a bright gold wave and soaked me, face, breasts, belly, and legs, and I had to hurry back to the booth, the small employee bathroom with the broken lock, to change my uniform, peeled the gas-soaked cloth from my skin, and wash myself in the sink. Light-headed, scrubbed raw, I felt pure and amazed. The way the amber gas glazed my flesh, the searing, subterranean pain of it, how my skin shimmered and ached, glowed like rainbowed oil on the pavement. I was 20. In a few weeks, I would fall, for the first time, in love. That man waiting patiently in my future, like a red leaf on the sidewalk. The kind of beauty that asks to be noticed. How was I to know it would begin this way? Every cell of my body burning with a dangerous beauty. The air around me, a nimbus of light that would carry me through the days. How when he found me, weeks later, he would find me like that. An ordinary woman who could rise in flame. All he would have to do is come close and touch me.
At some point, you started teaching in Oregon at the University of Oregon, and you joined the ranks of the people who have a desk and phone calls and meetings and that kind of stuff. Did you ever long back to have a job where at least your mind is yours?
Yeah, I mean, I love the teaching, of course, and I love students, and I love the classroom and talking to them about poetry, but faculty meetings, oh my gosh, it's really deadening. So I've just learned how to sit in the meetings and pretend like I'm diligently taking notes the whole time. But really what I'm doing is writing poetry.
Wow.
I also write with my students. I'll give my students an exercise to write in class. And then everybody will silently write for 15 or 20 minutes and I'll be writing right alongside them, you know.
Yes. That's so smart. I'm also curious, like when you are writing in a setting like that, would you be drawn to writing about what was right around you, or what would you write?
Well, every instance would be different, of course. You know, somebody might say a word in a meeting and that could set me off into a whole memory or whatever my mind had to offer up in that deadening hour.
Yeah. I'm asking you the question because you published this book, The Book of Men, in 2012, and it has a great number of poems on the men you've encountered throughout your life, and some of them you know, decades and decades ago when you were a teenager, for instance. But there's something about these poems and the detail in them and the way that they bring back a moment that I don't quite understand how that works. Could you tell me, like, how do you do that?
I know. I don't understand it either when I'm reading, especially memoir, where somebody brings back in detail some remembered moment in their lives. I just don't know. Some of it is what you think is actual memory, because as we know, it's flawed to begin with.
Yeah.
And some of it is just the artistic process. You know, you imagine what could have been around.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I'd like to make that specific, so maybe we can go to that poem, Bakersfield, 1969.
When is the year?
1969.
That was long ago. And yeah, somehow I remembered this moment. And if I can, I can find it, I will read it for you. Okay, so I found this poem, Bakersfield, 1969, on a website called The Chateau of My Heart. Isn't that a great title for a website?
That is great.
Anyway, here it is, Bakersfield. I used to visit a boy in Bakersfield, hitchhike to the San Diego terminal, and ride the bus for hours through the sun-blasted San Fernando Valley, just to sit on his fold-down bed in a trailer parked in the side yard of his parents' house, drinking Southern Comfort from a plastic cup. His brother was a sessions man for Taj Mahal, and he played guitar too, picked at it like a scab. Once his mother knocked on the tin door to ask us in for dinner. She watched me from the sides of her eyes while I ate. When I offered to wash the dishes, she told me she wouldn't stand her son being taken advantage of. I said I had no intention of taking anything and set the last dish carefully in the rack. He was a bit slow, like he'd been hit hard on the back of the head, but nothing dramatic. We didn't talk much anyway, just drank and smoked and fucked and slept through the ferocious heat. I found a photograph he took of me getting back on the bus, or maybe stepping off into his arms. I'm wearing jeans with studs punched along the cuffs, a t-shirt with stars on the sleeves, a pair of stolen bowling shoes, and a purse I made while I was in the loony bin, wobbly X's embroidered on burlap with gaudy orange yarn. I don't remember how we met. When I look at this picture, I think I might not even remember this boy if he hadn't taken it and given it to me, written his name under mine on the back. I stopped seeing him after that thing with his mother. I didn't know anything yet. I liked him. That's what I remember. That and the I don't know what degree heat that rubbed up against the trailer's metal sides, steamed in through the cracks between the door and porthole windows, pressed down on us from the ceiling and seeped through the floor, crushing us into the damp sheets. How we endured it, sweat streaming down our naked bodies, the air sucked from our lungs as we slept. Taj Mahal says, if you ain't scared, you ain't right. Back then, I was scared most of the time, but I acted tough, like I knew every street. What I liked about him was that he wasn't acting. Even his sweat tasted sweet.
Thank you. So, you know, this poem, the date is in the title. I mean, 1969. Yeah. So,
which may or may not be the year. I mean, that I might have.
Yeah,
made
but if it's in that ballpark.
It is in the ballpark.
And
yeah.
The book came out in 2012. So we're talking, you know, something like 40 years earlier.
Right.
How did you feel about your younger self?
I think it sort of reveals itself in the poem. You know, I think I felt when I looked back on that kind of callous young woman, at least toward the mother, and her casual feeling toward this young man, that she really, in looking back on it, falls in love with both of them, you know, and falls in love with that trailer and the heat and wishes that she had really been fully there, you know. The poem now allows her to be fully there.
Yeah.
I think she was only half there in reality.
That is interesting, because I always have this assumption that, you know, when you write poems the way you do, so full of this vivid detail, that it must be because you're just great at paying attention while you're in the moment.
No.
No.
No, no. You know, the way that I describe, I don't know if it had porthole windows. I don't know if it was as porous as I remember it being. Maybe it was airtight. I made some of that up. Yeah. Then again, the purse with the wobbly X's embroidered in burlap, that is absolutely true. You know, I remember that purse. And I loved it. I thought it was a great work of art. It was ugly when I look back on it. It's just the ugliest thing I've ever seen. And the Taj Mahal, of course, comes from a much different time. I mean, that's a whole other memory that found its way into the poem. But yeah, when I first thought back on it, all I could think was incredible discomfort, you know, the heat and the, and I was thinking, what possessed me to put myself through that much discomfort to get to this little uncomfortable trailer, you know? I mean, what in the world possessed me, except that clearly wherever I was, this was better than that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was something to do. It was an adventure for a young woman, you know?
Yeah.
I think if we think about it, or, you know, it's only when we look back that we can be fully, in some ways, you know, aware.
Yeah. So was it that picture that made you want to write
this
poem?
Yeah, I do actually have that picture. Of me getting on the bus in my jeans with the studs and my t-shirt with the stars, which I loved so much. Mm-hmm. What I didn't remember about it was the psychology of it, you know, what his mother was feeling and what I was feeling and maybe a little bit about what he was feeling. You know, when we're young like that, we just kind of fly through our lives without perceiving much of anything. It's only when we're able to look back through the lens of full adulthood or full maturity that we can see everybody's side.
Yeah. Yeah, it is true that as a young person, we don't really question the fact that we're central to our own lives.
Right.
And that's all we notice in a way.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting also that the fact that his mother said that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Was the end
again,
of that.
I don't know that she actually did. It's what... Mm. It was probably a way she looked at me that made me think that she would say something like that. I don't necessarily actually remember her saying that.
Yeah.
I know this is probably very disappointing for you, but...
No, yeah. This is really interesting, especially because, you know, when you said earlier, yeah, you think back of this girl who was maybe callous towards this boy in a way that his mom understood, but, you know, you didn't. But what also strikes me is how much tenderness there is for this girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like even the ugliness of that purse, you know, the self-made embroidery, you know,
right.
with gaudy orange yarn.
Right.
Sure, it's ugly, but you kind of feel for her because you know she loved that thing and she made it herself, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, there's something that I've always wanted to capture about the ugliness of California. I mean, everybody thinks of California as, you know, surfers and palm trees and, you know, this gorgeous tropical weather. But it's really quite disgusting, many parts of California. And Bakersfield has to be probably one of the most disgusting towns in all of California, which, of course, I will get letters and threats now from people who live in Bakersfield. But really, to be on a Greyhound bus, you know, on your way to Bakersfield is not a fun time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, so much of your poetry is really intense emotion, but written down in a way that is incredibly sober. You know, like this really, really famous Wordsworth quote, poetry is emotion recollected in tranquility.
Tranquility, yes. Well, when I was young, I read Play It As It Lays by Joan Didion. And I just reread it recently and realized how much I was influenced by that book and her voice. And the fact that she kept her, you know, I mean, the situations were always very extreme, but she kept her voice very monotone in a way, you know? She was never hysterical about it. And all emotion was kept at a very, and part of it is because it's so hot. You can't afford to lose the energy and the water content, you know, by getting too emotional. So I think I learned a lot from her how to keep my voice at a lower register when speaking about emotion. And then that, in fact, intensifies, allows the emotion to bloom up.
The last section in your latest collection, Only as the Days Long, your new and selected, is a series of new poems, many of them about your mother's death. And she died not so long ago before you came out with the book.
Right.
I mean, it seems like such a colossal feeling, so amorphous.
Right.
Did you... Because that, you know, you wrote those poems relatively soon after it happened. How do you get in, you know?
You know, well, I mean, that is something that I didn't believe that I would be able to write about at the time, that it would be indeed too fresh. But the fact is, I couldn't sleep. I would sit up all night thinking about her, you know, and the poems just came. And in fact, it may have been her death that allowed some of those poems to finally make their way into the world. That if she had been alive, I may have felt too intimidated or too, you know, self-conscious or concerned to write those poems.
By what?
Oh, just you know, my mother, I loved her so much, and she was so difficult, and she was very invested in my life as a poet and very invested in poems about her. And even though it's not as if those poems are in any way, I just think that she wouldn't have liked some of the visions of her.
And what were the things, I mean, we're all sensitive about things that, like, we just have our hang-ups, you know. What was that for your mother, where you were not meaning anything?
Well, I'll give you an example. Like, once I wrote a poem about her in which I said she drank a six-pack of beer and went to bed, which is true. And she was very upset. She did not want anyone to think she was an alcoholic, that she, you know. And so I changed it to she drank her dark beer and went to bed. So in other words, just a glass, like a normal person. And she was very happy with that. But it would have devastated her if I had said that. And it was easy enough to change for her, right? Well, I think that when she was gone, I no longer had to worry about that kind of thing. And I never could have predicted that would be something she would be so upset about. To me, it was the truth. You know, what's the big deal, Mom? But to her, it was about her dignity. And I did not want to mess with that.
Yeah. You know, I understand that, but I can also imagine that once she dies, that you are even more concerned with sort of being the... you know, the garden of her dignity, you know? Did you feel that at all, where you were like, oh, now I don't know if I should, you know?
Yeah, I really actually didn't have to worry too much about it because I love my mother so much. I knew that the love for her would come through no matter what I revealed about her. I would expect my own daughter to be able to reveal about me both the sides of me that she loves and the sides of me that she's not too thrilled with. I would expect that.
And I think
all of us would, because she wouldn't be a real living, breathing human being, which was really my only intent. I wanted people to know my mother as well as somehow I knew her, like to be able to present her as a full-blown human being in the world. That was, to me, quite fascinating. And I wanted people to somehow know her Which is, I think, the impulse for any writer, you know, in terms of character. You know, there are certain mm-hmm. characters that they just want the world to see and know and believe in, you know, that they lived, they had a sensibility in the world.
Yeah,
I don't think anyone ever picked up a phone like my mother did. You know, like she was wrenching it from the bowels of the devil himself, you know. I mean, she just, she had a way of being in the world that let you know that not only she was there, but she was passionately involved in it, you know, and that she was kind of making it as she walked through it. And she could be as powerful as she was, as dynamic, as beautiful, as tall and imposing. She was vulnerable and sad and dark and childlike and a whiner. And that was always something that fascinated me, to see both sides of my mother, to see her standing up to some powerful individual or institution, or, and then the next moment being on the floor just crawling and in pain and agony and misery. But that's who we are.
Yeah.
Here it is. There are a number of crows in the book, and I've always sort of thought of my mother as a crow. She had very dark, beautiful kind of raven hair. So this is my poem about her. When the air conditioner comes on, it sounds for all the world like my mother clearing her throat and then sighing. After she died, I'd shudder and look up, expecting to see her ghost. I wasn't afraid, just hopeful. To see her again, to hear her knees creak, her knuckles pop, the ash of her cigarette hiss and flare. I remember how she gargled with salt water, spit it into the sink, how she grabbed the phone with her claw, the back of her head sleek as a crow. My mother is a crow on my lawn, laughing with the others, flapping up on a branch, jerking and twisting her ruffed neck, looking around. I find her everywhere, her eyes staring out from aspen bark, the rivers of her hands, the horse's ankle bones. Astounding, such delicacy could bear such terrible weight.
Thank you. This writing of poems about a person who was so central, does that help grieving, or is it just a way to grieve?
Yeah, it's a way to grieve. But really, you're alleviated from the grieving process while you're writing. I'm very far away from grieving when I'm writing. I'm happy when I'm writing. I'm actually not anything. I'm just floating in the world. I'm a non-entity of light, you know, which is the most freeing thing
yes.
that you can be. So I'm freed of my grief. I'm freed of my joy. I'm just kind of, you know, something in the world creating.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, in some ways, during the writing of these poems, I was bringing her alive again. I was bringing her back. And I loved that, to have her with me. I've never had, since she's died, I've never really had a dream about her, or, you know, been able, you know, people talk about having dreams about
yeah.
And I always think they're mm-hmm. so lucky. I think I wish my mom had come back and talked to me in a dream.
Absolutely.
But since she won't, then I have to, you know, talk to her.
You know, in your the foreword to your debut collection, Awake, Philip Levine wrote that. He describes your poems in this perfect way. He said that they're sculptured, economical, tough. I still love that word sculptured. It makes me think of something that's truly there in the world, mm-hmm. you know, that you can touch. And I'm wondering, how do you help students make something as fleeting as a moment into something as solid as a stone?
Well, I ask them to just, you know, be really attentive to language in a way that frees your imagination.
Yeah.
And so often I have something that I use that a friend of mine who's a poet made, and it's called metaphor dice. And the dice have little phrases on them or words, and you throw the dice and you get these random words. And then I say, okay, now describe this chunk of lava using these words, you know. And it frees their mind up.
Right. That's such a terrific way to get into the last poem that I'll ask you to read. It's that poem, Enough Music. It's very short.
Oh, yeah. I may actually have that one memorized, do I? Let's see if I do. That would be fun.
It would be.
Let me see. Enough music. Sometimes when we're on a long drive and we've talked enough and listened to enough music and stopped once, twice to and stopped twice, once to see the view, once to pee. Once to pee, once to see the view. We fall into this rhythm of silence. It swings back and forth between us like a rope over a lake. Maybe it's what we don't say that saves us. So now, of course, I have it, you know, now that I've actually said it. But I can say it again if it'll be better. But yeah, what were you going to say about that poem?
Well, you know, you said earlier that you sometimes just sort of work with random words as a way to sort of shake up the way that we look at a thing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, what intrigues me about this poem is that, in a sense, it's a poem about exactly nothing happening, which is sort of one of the hardest things to describe, right? And
right.
and so you have this incredible metaphor of this rope swinging over
right.
a lake.
Right. I was actually reading a lot of Jack Gilbert, and Jack Gilbert writes very short poems where nothing happens and a lot happens.
Yeah.
And he doesn't use much metaphor, simile, or he uses mostly just hard nouns. And I was really trying to imitate that. And I had written mm-hmm. a number of poems that were small little poems. I mean, I wrote probably 200, and out of that 200, two of them worked. Very mm-hmm. bad ratio, but, you know, worth it. So this is, I found it here. I can't believe that I cannot remember it anymore. But what it did remind me of is that it used to say, once to pee, once to see the view. And I think my editor made me change it, wanted me to change it to eat. Once to eat, once to see the view. So that just lets you know how big censorship is in America these days. Okay, so this is it. Enough music. Sometimes when we're on a long drive and we've talked enough and listened to enough music and stopped twice, once to eat, once to see the view, we fall into this rhythm of silence. It swings back and forth between us like a rope over a lake. Maybe it's what we don't say that saves us.
That's incredible. Is there still a big impulse for you to write?
You know, I just finished this new and selected. I'm 68 years old. I'm moving back and forth across the country teaching. We're caretaking a son right now who had a stroke. Mm-hmm. You know, we are so busy in our retirement that we hardly have time to sleep. But I'm holding out for 70. That by 70, I'll actually be able to fully retire and everyone will leave us alone and we can just go live by the ocean and write. You know, by then I'll probably be in the early stages of dementia and so it won't really matter anymore. But so, no, actually I haven't written for a while. I certainly have a lot of poems. I have more than enough poems for another book if I want, but whether or not I have the energy to put it together is another issue altogether.
Oh, totally. Especially when editors want to change things like P to M.
I'm glad you appreciate that.
Absolutely. Dorian, this was so lovely. I'm really flattered that you want to spend the time, even though you're too busy to sleep.
Dorian Locks is the author of 6 books: Awake, What We Carry, Smoke, Facts About the Moon, The Book of Men, which won the Patterson Prize and the Roanoke Schwann Award, and her new and selected Only As the Day Is Long. She also won a Pushcart Prize and a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, and her poems have been translated into French, Italian, Korean, Romanian, Afrikaans, Dutch, and Brazilian Portuguese. In 2020, she was elected Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. She lives with her husband, the poet Joseph Miller, in Raleigh, North Carolina, where she's been teaching at the MFA program of North Carolina State University. To find out more about her work, check out the Poetry Foundation website. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos. I'm Helena de Groots, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.